It's being called the worst humanitarian crisis of our generation. Why aren't we talking about it more?
There's not enough food, there's not enough water. They're living in bombed out basements and schools.
Why aid organizations need you to help. Plus, the modern reality of what happens when science creates families. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, the Women's Perspective. The civil war in Syria is in its third year, and experts say it is one of the worst humanitarian crises of our generation. International attention focused on the conflict when poison gas was used in an attack on Damascus in August. But news reports indicate that a brutal campaign of so-called cleansing continues around the country, with witnesses saying the government basically dumped huge containers of shrapnel, including dumpsters, and bombs on buildings in an air attack on September 3rd to clear a town of what the government said were terrorists. The strategy destroyed the town of Aria and forced everyone in it, civilian and rebel, to abandon it forever. According to Save the Children, 2 million people have fled the country, but 4 million children are still there, hungry, in need of medicine, and without a safe home. 1 in 3 of those children have been the target of violence. 75% of them have lost a loved one. 7,000 children are dead. And Save the Children President and CEO Carolyn Miles set a priority is finding a way to get aid to those who need it. Studies indicate that 70% of health aid workers are unable to get to where they're needed.
Our big push on Syria is to try to get people to recognize the huge humanitarian crisis that is happening in Syria and the surrounding countries. There are 7 million people, Syrians, right now in need of aid, about 5 million inside the country, and about 2 million refugees, and about half that 7 million are children. So it is a huge, huge humanitarian crisis, and we're really trying to get people to forget a little bit about the political issues. Obviously, those are really important, but the humanitarian issue is something we can all do something about.
How do you thread that needle then, Carolyn, when you've got a country with a huge human rights issue and disapproval from the global community combined with the need of the people who live in that country?
Well, first of all, it's incredibly difficult, and our staff are in a lot of danger when they do this, but this is the job that we do, and we are also working with a lot of local partners, and our position is that we're going to supply aid to those who need it, and really it's, you know, civilians in this case that are caught in between the warring factions. They aren't rebels or government or anything else. They're just people who, you know, we're leading normal lives before this war broke out. And so those are the people that we're trying to reach. There's not enough food. There's not enough water. They're living in bombed out basements and schools. And so we're trying to reach those people.
Do you find yourself relying on military intelligence to figure out how to get that aid where it's needed without taking sides in the conflict?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things we're really pushing, and this is now more on the UN side at the UN meetings, is that we need access and we need protected access. We need a humanitarian corridor into Syria that we can make sure that the aid can get through and the people delivering the aid can be safe. And that's really what we need. And in most humanitarian crises, this is what you call for. And in many of them, that's how you get the aid to people. So that is what we want to happen. And again, that's a call to the UN on that particular issue.
And Carolyn, another item on your policy agenda is to increase the role of women and girls in governments, in policy, in decision making, in community.
It's a really pretty simple concept. Half the world is female, and if we are kind of holding down half the population from being able to develop and advance, in particularly in developing countries, it's going to be very hard for that country to move ahead. So that's making sure that girls get into school in the first place, making sure they get through school, making sure that they're getting the learning that they need to have, you know, fighting child marriage, so girls are not getting married at the age of 13, making sure that women and girls are able to make the reproductive choices they need to make for their children. So those are some of the things that we're working on. And we think if we can get to that point, we will have a much, much stronger future in many of these countries where Save the Children works.
And all of this seems very obvious to someone raised in a Western tradition, but how do you get this accepted in a culture with a long-standing tradition of not seeing things this way?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a great question, and our work is very much on the ground in communities, so we are working with communities, and a lot of times we're working with leaders in those communities. They might be village chiefs, they might be imams, they might be, mayors in cities, but really getting their buy-in, working with men. So it's not kind of just working with women and not working with men. It's working with men and fathers and really putting forth the argument that, this is good for your family. It's good for girls to be able to be educated, and it's good for girls to be able to, you know, advance and fulfill their potential. And so it's working with communities, not kind of around communities. And our teams are usually from those places. So this isn't a bunch of Americans kind of flying in. This is Nepalese talking to Nepalese and Ethiopians talking to Ethiopians. And that's the way you're going to really make these changes.
And what seems to be most effective? Is it working within the community and showing examples with people in that community, or is it working generationally and working with the next generation to try to affect change?
Yeah, I would say it's both. It's both kind of holding up those role models of girls who have been successful in those communities and what they've been able to do. And it's also, as you said, it's getting the voices of children for children. And a lot of times, as we all know, you know, in the Western world, it's often our kids that are driving change. I mean, if you think about the recycling revolution in the United States, a lot of that was driven by school children who came home and said, you know, this is what we have to do. And we use those same kinds of techniques in the countries where we work and get kids to stand up for these things.
And for those of us who aren't in this field, it would seem to be a very slow trudge. I'm sure there are little victories, and those little victories maybe add up to big change eventually, but one can lose heart. How do you maintain the optimism and the energy to move forward, not just as a leader of a group, but among the people in that group who are on the ground working?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, first of all, to look at some of the successes there have been. So the child survival issue is one where in 1990, over 12 million kids died every year of preventable diseases. And in 2012, that number was down to 6.6 million. Now, 6.6 million kids dying of preventable things is still too many, but it's basically cut in half. And so we have to look at those successes and celebrate those successes. And then you kind of say, okay, now we've got to go forward and finish the job. And, our staff are some of the most dedicated people I've ever met. They are just tremendous. They're very committed. And frankly, they could have left their countries, most of them, and come to work in the United States or in the UK or in Germany and probably had much easier lives. And they have chosen to stay in their countries and make change there. And they're really tremendous people. People can go to our website at savethechildren.org, and they can learn a lot more about our work and also sign our petition on Syria. And we would love people to get engaged and involved.
Carolyn Miles is President and Chief Executive Officer for Save the Children. In 2012, Save the Children helped more than 125 million children in the U.S. and in 120 countries around the world. Find out more at savethechildren.org. Coming up, some frank talk about the reality of a family created by science and a movement to get rid of diapers for good. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1272. Our definition of family has certainly widened over the past couple of generations, with MTV about to air a program about a girl searching for the sperm donor who is her father, and 2010's film The Kids Are All Right about the children of a lesbian couple who want to know their mother's sperm donor. That definition is expanding yet again. Cindy Swingen of Portland, Oregon, chose to create her own family. Her two children have the same father, a man none of them knows. Producer Julie Sabatier brings us this interview.
Cindy felt ready to be a mom. She was financially stable, owned a home, and she was in a good place with her career as a teacher. The one thing she didn't have was a partner. So she decided to start a family on her own.
I always knew I was going to be a parent. I always knew I was going to be a teacher and a parent. And at first I was going to China to adopt, and that was really prohibitively expensive. You had to have people come to your house and social workers kind of inspecting your life and going through all your tax records, and you don't know any of the baby's history. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I should just think about having my own instead. And I went to OHSU Andrology Lab, which is the name for their fertility clinic, and was told that it cost, I think it was $400 or $450 a try for intrauterine insemination, and that there was no prerequisite screening of any kind. You could just go try. I got my son right away. And then 3 years later, I got pregnant with the same donor sperm and got my daughter.
How did you select your donor?
Kind of an intellectual snob, I think it would be safe to say. And the three most educated were a lawyer, a fish biologist, and a teacher. I'm very short, and the lawyer was also very short. And so I decided that that wouldn't be fair to my kids. I'd like them to have a chance at having a little bit of height. And then with the fish biologist, I thought, well, that's a scientist, and I'm more on the literary side of things. And so I thought, well, that would be really good balance to have a scientist mixed with me. Then I thought, I'm going to be spending a lot of time with these people. Maybe I want someone who's more like me than less like me. And so I went with the teacher.
Did you know anything about his race or heritage?
I picked someone white, and it's been interesting because my children have been asking me about that lately. Like, my son wishes that I had picked a Latino donor. He's kind of fascinated with that culture, and I said, but I really did think about it. But I thought, you know, most of the people I've dated in my life have been white. When I was married to a white man. And so I thought, well, it would seem sort of contrived if I picked someone who wasn't white. So I did pick someone who was white, and I knew certain things about him, like he was a twin, and I knew what his grandparents had died from and how educated everyone in his family was. And they screened the donors for every known disease, you know, MS and diabetes and everything else. So they were very well screened, way better than I could have done on my own. And I know gorgeous people with homely babies and homely people with gorgeous babies. And I didn't care really what he looked like because I figured it'd just be my baby and that's all that mattered.
And why did you decide to do this as a single person?
I was getting older. I was 32. And it was easy doing it by myself. And I know that's going to sound kind of funny, but I didn't have any expectations of myself except doing my job well and parenting well. And so because my expectations were so low, I was able to meet all the goals that I had for myself. And this is my own bias. Before you have children, you need to own a home and have a master's degree. And that is, I know, completely ridiculous because a lot of people have children have neither one of those things. But I knew for me, I needed to get those things in place. And I had no intention of having children before I had those things in place because I didn't want to go back to school and get a master's after my kids were born, and I wanted the stability of having a home.
What was your family's reaction?
My family was thrilled for me. My family always knew that I would be a parent, and they were perfectly happy.
Did you get any strange reactions from your students' parents on this and how you talked to the students about it?
Just one. I called all my students' parents when at 12 weeks when I was pregnant with Matthew. It was over Thanksgiving vacation. And I called them and told them I was going to be having a baby, and I wasn't going to lie and say I was married, and that I'd like them to tell their children that I was going to have a baby. And I only had one parent who kind of bristled a little bit and said, oh, really? And I really thought I'd get more pushback than that. And then that was the one child who asked me about it later. And we were coloring something. I remember we were coloring this kimono thing. And he said, so you're having a baby, but you don't have a man in your life? And I said, yeah, that's right. Really cute kid. I'm friends with him on Facebook now. He's like 25 years old. And he said, so I don't understand how you can be pregnant. And I said, well, it was more scientific than romantic. And he said, oh. And that was the end of the conversation.
Do you feel like you're doing this all by yourself?
When they were little, it was harder because when they were sick, it was really hard. One time my son was sick when he was 2.5 and I was like 8 months pregnant and we were both sick. And that was really, those times are hard. You know, sometimes holidays were a little lonely with my tiny family, you know, just waking up with my two little kids on Christmas morning. But I haven't felt too lonely because I can pretty much get a family member over to my house at any time that I want to. And I have an excellent care provider who will take care of my kids anytime. And I didn't go to the movies or a restaurant, I remember, for 2 years, because when I finally went, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm at the movies. But I never felt sorry for myself because it was exactly what I wanted to be doing. I just wanted to be a parent, and so that's what I was doing. Well, after you have that first baby, you can't pick a different donor, because what would you be saying to that first baby? Like, you know, I thought I could do better, or you didn't turn out that well. It just became a ridiculous question. Of course I would pick the exact same donor, because here's this, you know, beloved son, and to have a full sibling would, you know, be the best gift to give him. And so it never occurred to me to not after I had him.
How do you talk to your kids about their dad?
Oh, we kid around a little bit about it because they both really like onions. And I don't like onions at all. And I'm like, oh, that your dad must like onions because that, you know, he didn't get that from me or whatever, you know, thing they do. But I always knew that I could. Well, I thought I could. There have been times I've had my confidence shaken, but I thought I could raise him by myself. I just couldn't start them by myself. And so that's why I said, a nice man, let me have a piece of him so we could start you, because it takes a man piece and a woman piece to start a baby. And so I went to a doctor's office, and doctor helped me get you started. And then from then on, I could raise you by myself. And I don't think about him very much, because you don't miss what you never had.
At what age did you decide to start talking to your children about it? Or what age did they start asking?
I don't know that they ever asked. I never didn't talk to them about it. So it was never a secret. There was no big reveal. I just talked about the man who helped me start you. Because sometimes there are friends or something who say, well, you don't have a father. I said, well, everybody has a father. You have a father. We just don't know him. And people say, what does he look like? We don't know. And so that was a little bit weird. But it's more weird for other people than it is for our family.
What if they, you know, when they're older, they, you know, as sometimes happens with people who are in close adoption situations, for example, where they get to a certain age where they really want to find out about their parents or parent in this situation. Mm-hmm. What do you think would be your reaction if, you know, your kids are 18, 20, and they come to you and they say, I really want to figure this out?
I would support them 100% because I'm so proud of my kids that I can't imagine that everyone in the world wouldn't want to get to know them, you know. So to say, these are the people you made possible, thank you, to him would be wonderful. And I would love it for them to know him. On paper, he seemed like a great guy. And then I actually did meet someone who knows him at a party, someone who worked at the andrology lab, and I was pregnant with my daughter. And she didn't know how I was pregnant. And it was just at a birthday party of a mutual friend. And she told me where she worked. And I said, oh, do you know donor? And then I said his number. And she said, oh, yeah, he's a great guy. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I have like 10 seconds. She can't reveal anything about him. So I just thought, well, what do I want to know? What do I want to know? And I just said, well, you know, what's he like? And she said, oh, he's just a great guy. He's really funny, super friendly, nice guy. And I thought, I don't need to know anything else.
Cindy Swingen is a teacher and a mom in Portland, Oregon. Her kids, Matthew and Laura, are 13 and 10.
And finally, let's talk about babies and diapers. Our grandmothers wrapped our parents in cloth nappies when they were babies. Our mothers raised us during the transition from diaper services to disposable. But as we become aware of the environmental nightmare those nearly indestructible disposables are, today's parents are looking for alternatives. What if you and your baby just didn't use any? Lisa Goldberg and Rebecca Steinfeld of Homefront Chronicles speak to a mom who's not buying the diaper story.
What if you never have to change a diaper for your new baby and, at the same time, save the environment from thousands of disposable diapers?
While pregnant, single mother Angela decided to try raising her daughter without diapers. This practice, known as elimination communication, is a process in which a parent observes a baby's signs and signals and helps them to use the bathroom. Little known in the U.S., it is used regularly in many other countries around the world.
I had never questioned diapers or the use of them or our culture and how we did potty training until I was about 9.5 months pregnant. And a woman came into a birthing class, and she had just given birth and had a little boy. She started cueing, making cueing noises to him while he went to the bathroom. And so I was just blown away by this idea. And I started doing research and found out that historically and all around the world, that's what people have done up until basically 1961 when disposable diapers were introduced. And then that started changing. So it was understood that eliminating, just like eating and sleeping, is something that we are sort of evolutionarily inclined to do. It's not something that we are completely unaware of until 2 years old, which is what we're taught in this culture. So when I started to look into it, I realized that I wanted to have something different for my daughter. It didn't make any sense to have her waddling around in diapers until she was 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, like kids are in the United States. And the United States does have the oldest potty training age in the history of the world. So I started to research that and started to practice it with my daughter, just paying attention to her communication and giving her feedback through elimination cues and doing sign language with her. Started her on a little potty chair at 3 months old, and she would have it between my legs and she would face me. And just developed this really extraordinary bond. She was fully potty trained at 18 months. I saved thousands of dollars on diaper costs and diaper related situations, and the environmental impact is absolutely enormous. I think it's like 22 million tons of disposable diaper garbage that's put into landfills each year just in the United States. And those disposable, quote unquote, disposable diapers aren't going anywhere. They're going to be around for 400, 500 years. I think it's incredibly important, you know, and especially because we have this huge environmental movement that's going on. And I feel like, you know, going to the Green Festival and the Mother Earth News Festival, and people aren't talking about potty training. It's just kind of like this dirty little secret, you know. Nobody's saying anything about the fact that if we're really wanting to look at our footprint here, yes, buying local food and things like that is very important. But how many kids do you have? 2, 3 kids, or even one? I mean, that's millions and billions of pounds of filth that's sitting in landfills. Those disposable diapers aren't going anywhere. We're training our kids to ignore their bodies, to ignore their bodily sensations for 2 full years. It just doesn't make sense when you really think about it. And so recognizing that here's this little tiny amazing little infant that I had just given birth to, and that she had this awareness and she was indeed communicating with me that she had to go, just I had to stop ignoring those communication feeds that she was giving me. So once I tapped into it, we just took off. I mean, I use disposable diapers at times. I use cloth at times. I'm not a hippie. I'm not rich. I don't have a supportive husband. I mean, I didn't sit around all day and watch my child to see when she was going to use the bathroom. Like, there's certain things that you can do in a modern day family, in a modern day environment, in order to make it work better.
Angela Graham is the author of Potty Trained by Two, Wisdom from the Past to Better Our Future. You can find her book at pottytrainedby2.com.
Homefront Chronicles is produced by Lisa Goldberg and Rebecca Steinfeld in Seattle.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.